From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The Pope arrived in Ecuador Tuesday to find himself presented with a real-world test of his pronouncements on poverty and wealth. Pope Francis began his visit with his latest message of social justice and unity, only to find himself in the midst of a month of right-wing protests over wealth redistribution. Telesur's Liz Scherfius filed this report from Ecuador's capital, Quito.
Unity and social harmony are what many people here want. Some have been waiting days to get into Quito's Bicentenario Park for Tuesday's papal mass. The visit of Pope Francis comes after a month of violent protests by Ecuador's conservative opposition against government attempts to redistribute wealth.
I think he is a messenger of peace. He's what the Catholic Church has needed.
When he arrived at Quito's airport on Sunday, Pope Francis said that Ecuador could always count on the church for support. And he said the best way to resolve differences is through dialogue.
You have shown that you agree with my way of thinking. You have quoted me too often. Thank you. In return, I wish you the best with your mission and that you achieve what you want for the good of your people.
3 weeks ago, the Ecuadorian government suspended its proposals for taxes on wealth and urged all citizens to take part in a national debate on equality and wealth redistribution.
Now that we are going through a very difficult situation, maybe Pope Francis can give guidance. That is what this dialogue is for. If I have more, I should share some of it. And if another person has nothing, I should share what I have with them. That's how it should be.
Despite the tension of recent weeks, the Pope's visit is bringing the people of Ecuador together through their faith. More than 80% of the people here are Catholic. Music and prayers could be heard for many blocks around the Bicentenario Park as believers secured their spots for a mass that more than 1 million people are expected to attend. Emotions are running high here in front of the Bicentenario Park as people began arriving yesterday morning from across Ecuador as well as from Colombia and Peru. They have come with their tents as well as with their open hearts and minds, awaiting the papal mass, which will be led by Pope Francis tomorrow. They're waiting for messages filled with values of social justice as well as hope for humanity. Liz Scherfius, Telesur, Ecuador.
Talks between Iran and the so-called P5+1 countries, the U.S., U.K., France, Russia, China and Germany have been extended to this coming Friday. A lack of consensus among P5+1 members was cited as the reason behind the continuation of the talks, with a source close to Iran's negotiating team saying the P5+1 group of countries are struggling with a decision to lifting sanctions, which Tehran says is an essential part of any agreement. Iran and the P5+1 group of countries have been negotiating to hammer out a final deal on Tehran's nuclear program. Press TV's Omaleski was in Vienna Tuesday for the announcement.
We are standing here outside Hotel Palais Coburg. We saw the Chinese foreign minister walk out of the hotel and he got into a car to go for the Shanghai and BRICS conference that's taking place in Russia. In fact, he met with Foreign Minister Zarif and the Iranian foreign minister said that he also had the same plans to join the Iranian president, Mr. Rouhani, in that trip to Russia, but he has to stay here because, as you said, the negotiations have been extended. We're hearing, as you said there, the United States announcing that it has announced basically that the technical work is being done to extend the joint plan of action that we're referring there to the Geneva agreement between Iran and the P5+1 has been extended to the 10th of July. So that will be basically the next deadline now. If we're going to be speaking practically, we may have an agreement before that or we may not have an agreement by then. Nothing is certain. As U.S. Secretary of State put it a few days ago, it could go either way. We are hearing among the differences includes the duration of a joint comprehensive plan of action. We know that there was talk previously, at least according to the U.S. fact sheet, after the Lausanne framework or the Lausanne joint statement, that they expect Iran to restrict certain aspects of its nuclear program, including, for instance, the level and scope of enrichment for 10 years. It seems to me that Iran wants to discuss about lesser time than that. also research and development, we're hearing, was causing at least some problems. If that has been resolved or not, or near resolution, we don't know. Although sources were telling us that Iran, in principle, has made it clear to the other side, and the other side has accepted that it should be able to do research and development, even on advanced centrifuges. Maybe there's some technical discussions still ongoing about the schedule of that activity. And also, among the issues that's causing disagreement, we're hearing includes the PMD issue, or possible military dimensions of Iran's nuclear program, which has been pursued by the International Atomic Energy Agency. We know that Yuki Amano, the IAEA head, just said a few days back here that he believes that by the end of the year, the IAEA can come up with a report on the PMD issue. Iran says that it sees the political will now on the other side to get this issue resolved. It has said before that it doesn't believe the PMD actually exists because it believes its program is peaceful. It wants to be very transparent about that as well, just to clarify that point.
The congressional leadership and large numbers of members of both houses have expressed concerns and even outright opposition to any agreements with Iran. But according to James Jotras, a former Senate foreign policy analyst, they cannot stop the White House from finalizing a deal.
It's pretty clear that a large number of congressmen and senators are opposed to the deal of both parties because they agree with the Israeli position that this would eventually allow Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. Whether that's accurate or not, it's another question. They do strongly believe that. Now, we have to understand this agreement, if it is finalized, which I expect it to be, will not be sent to Congress for approval. It is not a treaty under American law, and I don't think there's any way that Mr. Obama could get legislation through Congress supporting it. By the same token, there's very little Congress can do to actually stop the agreement. A resolution disapproving the agreement will not stop whatever degree Mr. Obama can use his executive authority to carry it out. The problem is that the next president could change that when he or conceivably she comes into office.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said Tuesday that the civilian death toll in the Yemen conflict now exceeds 1,500 people, with over 3,600 injured since U.S.-directed airstrikes by Saudi Arabia began on March 27th against the country. Press TV's Bardia Honardar has more.
The civilian death toll from the Saudi military campaign in Yemen is mounting as warplanes keep pounding various locations across the impoverished country. In the latest attacks, Saudi jets targeted a military base and a government building in Idlib province. Elsewhere, at least 54 people lost their lives in the bombardment of the northern city of Amran. Some 20 people have also been killed after a police checkpoint was targeted at the entrance of the city. Earlier, more than 50 civilians were killed and dozens injured as Saudi aircraft attacked a local market in Lahij province. The UN says 80% of Yemen's population need immediate help and 15 million people have no health care.
Gaza is still in crisis 1 year after its conflict with Israel ended, according to UN humanitarian workers Tuesday. In addition to the 1,462 civilians killed by Israeli airstrikes and shelling during 51 days of fighting, 100,000 people are now displaced inside Gaza, that according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Daniel Johnson reports from the United Nations.
1 year after the fighting ended with Israel, people living in Gaza are in crisis. That's the assessment of the UN Agency for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA. The agency says that civilians are still paying the highest price for the 51-day conflict, which it calls the most deadly and destructive escalation of hostilities since the beginning of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories in 1967. OCHA spokesperson Jens Lack had described how civilians were prevented from fleeing the Gaza Strip and were left with no safe place to hide. And he said that the conflict also resulted in the largest internal displacement recorded in Gaza since 1967, with an estimated 485,000 people on the move at the height of the fighting.
Today, 1 year on, the message from our colleagues in the humanitarian country team is that despite the end of the hostilities on the 26th of August last year, the crisis has essentially never stopped. And the unprecedented levels of destruction and death continues to traumatize the people in Gaza.
But providing aid to those in need and for rebuilding is proving difficult amid unprecedented funding shortages, OCHA says. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
China's leaders have unveiled a new pledge to curb carbon emissions ahead of the Paris Global Climate Change Summit later this year. While climate change remains a very real challenge, Many are hoping that China's commitments to tackle the problem will add momentum to the carbon-cutting movement. The ambitious targets, announced on June 30th, include an up to 65% reduction in carbon dioxide emissions per unit of gross domestic product, or GDP, from the 2005 level, that to be achieved by 2030, with a peak in carbon dioxide emissions also coming in 2030. Zhu Ji, Vice Director of the National Center for Climate Change Strategy and International Cooperation, said the pledged targets were in line with the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. He predicted that China's annual per capita carbon dioxide emissions peak will be no more than 10 tons, about half the level in the United States. China aims to reduce carbon emissions by an average annual rate of 3.6 to 4.1% until 2030. After last week's announcement, CCTV's Tian Wei spoke with Wu Changhua, Director for Greater China of the Climate Group, a nonprofit co-founded by former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair, Wang Dao from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center for Global Policy, and Li Xu from Greenpeace, about the announcement and what it means for the Paris Climate Summit and the environment generally.
Two major pledges that the world is looking. One is the greenhouse gas emission peak by the year 2030 or even earlier. Second, the carbon intensity cut to 60 to 65% compared to 2005 by the year 2030. What do you think about these two pledges? How easy they are or difficult they are?
I wouldn't use it as easy or difficult to describe it. I would use probably ambitious to describe it. And I think it's a very ambitious target, and China definitely is aiming higher. But this is also achievable. I think it's not so too far off because it's built on solid track record in the last 10 decades. Also, starting in the 11th five-year plan, we set a 20% energy intensity target. Then current 12th five-year plan, we added more. We set a 16% energy intensity target, a 17% carbon intensity target. Then leading up to 2020, back in 2009, we set a 40 to 45%. So it's just, you know, steps forward. I think definitely China's today's commitment by 2030 is a step forward leading up to 2030.
But Mr. Wang, some have already said, at least foreign analysts suggest China could do more. They were suggesting, you know, carbon intensity, why not 70% or even more? And they say, well, the greenhouse gas emission peak, why not 2025 to make that promise? What do you think about these kind of analysis?
I think in terms of analysis, you can always try different possibilities. So there is always assumptions, indicators you can change and make the things with some, slightly different outcomes. But we should not forget there is also very strong uncertainties when we implement all those measures. Sometimes you can quite easily to change the parameters, but in the realities, they are not always go the direction that you wish. So for example, today, China's economy is in the middle of the transition towards a more normalized, better structure and also energy structures, but nobody can say this is already being complete. And there is still risks that our economy may not be transformed into a more sustainable economy successfully and smoothly. So there is still uncertainty, and also there are uncertainties in the energy transitions, depending on where we get the energy and also the other issues. So I think you can never be 100% certain.
Mr. Li, from the Greenpeace perspective, there are two questions people ask when China has already made many applauded these kind of pledges. But they ask questions. China did not answer as to what exactly is going to be the amount of the peak, let's just say, by the year 2030. And China did not say specifically as to how fast the peak would decline once the peak is being reached. So, from what you read, from your knowledge and your conversations with experts, what are likely to be the possible answers to these questions?
Well, I mean, I think, let me just say, I very much agree with the previous two panelists, but let me just also compliment our view by saying that we very much view the 60 to 65% as well as the peaking around 2030 pledges as our starting point. It is a very important political step forward in our view. But again, we think given the latest energy transition in China, by which I mean, for example, the coal decline last year in China, we very much think that there are more space to enhance the ambition. And I think from a global climate point of view, what we saw so far for all the major emitters, their post-2020 climate target would not add up to help us maintain 2 degrees, below 2 degrees. And that's what climate scientists require us to do.
Okay. Well, I should ask you really this, Mr. Wang, because you are an expert on energy. So what do you make of the distinction, for example, between ambition and goal? That's one issue. The other issue is for the 2%, two degrees, as Mr. Li mentioned, how much is it in the eyes of the negotiators leading up to Paris this time? Or this is mainly becoming a target for the scientific and environmental community rather than, let's just say, the politicians and the negotiators for Paris. Help us to understand these 2 points.
Okay, let me answer the second question first. I think there is a lot of discussions around whether we can still achieve the 2 degrees C target, and the commitment that China recently just pledged is still in the range of meeting a 2 degrees C, given that other countries could also make the similar level of the commitment. But I think also there is uncertainties in the science. So what we are trying to do is we are, yes, at the range, within the range of a relatively stable or secured climate targets. But we still need to work together with other countries to improve our ambitions, to raise up the efforts, so we will be able to more certain that we were going to avoid the climate change worst impact. So that is something we still add up from 10 to 10, and also we need a review process to help us to understand what is the process of the climate change, because at the 10, we probably can do a lot of predictions, but we still have to check with realities.
That's true, because from now until 2030, even 2020, there's still quite a few years to go. What do you make of difference between ambition and targets?
Ambition is a direction, is how high you want to go forward.
Exactly.
And when you set up a goal, even further to objectives, that's going to be very specific. Say, as milestones are actually leading up to the future, your level of ambition. So you could say, my ambition level is this high, and I set a goal exactly the same level. Mm. Ambition is sort of, there's a lot of uncertainties basically there. Rather, so, and we are very ambitious. We want to definitely, we know the direction, we know the certainty, we definitely want to travel that way.
Right.
But in order to get there, probably we need to set goals on a periodical basis so that we learn through that process so that we lead up to...
Talking about the goals on a periodic basis, Ms. Wu, the conference in Paris this time, later this year, is very different from Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. For one thing, Copenhagen is trying to set up a global mechanism with which to monitor every country's target and how it's been meeting the target with a global mechanism. Mm. But this time, it is not going to do that because that's mainly how Copenhagen failed. But on the other hand, we cannot just let countries go free-willing and pledge whatever they want to do, not necessarily following up on their goals. So what is the likely balance that's going to happen globally on this point?
I think the biggest difference between Copenhagen and this year is this: Copenhagen is more like top-down, and now learning through the failure actually of Copenhagen, now we're giving more space to put bottom-up. Mm.
Bottom-up meaning countries leading
countries
to international
communities. Voluntarily say,
yes,
this is my intended actually contributions there. That's why it's called INDC. But in the meantime, it's not a free-willing. It's not like, say, whatever you said, that's it.
Mm.
Rather, the international process is also negotiating to set up a review process, to set up a reporting process, so to make sure, see, whatever you said you said you're going to do as
right.
a country on the table, that's going to put in a framework, make sure you review that or even adjust that actually along the way.
On that, Mr. Li, we've already heard in our backgrounder that the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, was talking about the speed the countries are pledging for their targets for the Paris conference. He said it's as slow as the snail, and he's very much urging countries to act more and faster. But we have not been seeing much actions at all. Are you optimistic as to what capitals would do, even though China has already pledged?
Well, I think we are in a very, very different position than 6 years ago when we were before Copenhagen. I think there are very, very high level and very, very extensive political attention be given to the issue of climate change. I think just two cases in point. One is the U.S.-China climate joint announcement that happened last November. You now see the two toughest emitters, their leaders coming together and declaring their long-term climate goal. And I think the other example is the recent Chinese submission of the post-2020 climate target during Premier Li's visit to Paris. France will be hosting this year's climate summit. So I think these two cases highlight the fact that there are very, very high and extensive political tension. And with that, I'm hopeful that the Paris conference this year will make a difference.
The world got a mixed report card on the global effort to reduce poverty, promote gender parity, and fight diseases such as HIV/AIDS and malaria. That, according to a UN report on the so-called Millennium Development Goals, or MDGs, which opened in Oslo, Norway, Monday. Detailing what its authors called the most successful anti-poverty movement in history, the report laid out significant successes and significant shortfalls towards the achievement of the 8 MDGs set forth in the year 2000. The report contains a compilation of data from the more than 28 UN and international agencies that have been monitoring progress on the MDGs, whose deadline is December 31st of this year. Nevertheless, as UN General Secretary Ban Ki-moon pointed out Monday, many of the world's people are still being left behind, despite the successful achievement of many of the goals set a decade and a half ago. Deanne Penn reports from the United Nations.
The MDG 2015 report confirms how goal setting has lifted millions of people out of extreme poverty, from nearly 2 billion in 1990 to 836 million in 2015. Thanks to the Millennium Development Goals, more girls are in school and more women are participating in government, with the average proportion of women parliamentarians nearly doubling over the past 20 years. On the medical front, new HIV infections fell by approximately 40% between 2000 and 2013, while more than 6 million malaria deaths have been averted. However, the report shows that while significant gains have been made on many of the MDG targets worldwide, progress has been uneven across regions and countries, resulting in significant gaps. While in Norway, as Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon called for more action to reach the world's most vulnerable people, those who have not shared in the improvements over the past 15 years. Progress, he said, has not reached everyone, and it is the poor who are mostly being affected by conflict and climate change.
Too many people have been left behind, particularly the poorest and those disadvantaged because of their sex, age, disability, ethnicity, or geographic location. Too many women and children continue to die during pregnancy or from childbirth-related complications. And too many people lack adequate sanitation facilities, especially in rural areas.
Mr. Ban described the MDGs as a springboard for future progress. He said the world cannot allow these hard-won and fragile gains to be diminished or reversed. World leaders will build on the momentum generated by the MDGs when they meet at the UN this September to adopt a new sustainable development agenda for the period beyond 2015. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
Monday's launch of the 2015 Millennium Development Goals report opened with a press conference where Wu Hongbo, Undersecretary General for Economic and Social Affairs, Stefan Schweinfest, Director of the Statistics Division, and Holly Newby, Chief of the Data Analysis Unit at the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, presented some of the information contained in the 2015 MDG report.
In the year 2000, world leaders embarked on the landmark commitment to eradicate extreme poverty and improve the lives of people across the globe. Those commitments were translated into 8 aspirational goals enshrined in the MDGs. We have come very far and have made remarkable gains. More than 1 billion people have been lifted out of extreme poverty. The proportion of people suffering from hunger has fallen almost by half. More girls attend school than ever before. The global under five mortality rate has declined by more than a half. New HIV infections have fallen by 40%. Millions of deaths have been averted thanks to the expansion of HIV, AIDS, malaria, and TB interventions. Since 1990, 2.6 billion people have gained access to improved drinking water, and 2.1 billion people have gained access to improved sanitation. Thanks to the concerted global efforts to eliminate ozone depleting substances, the ozone layer is projected to recover by mid-century. 95% of the world is now covered by a mobile cellular signal. But progress has been uneven across regions and countries. Gender equality persists, and women continue to face discrimination in access to work and decision-making. Big gaps still exist between the poorest and the richest, between rural and urban areas. Climate change and environmental degradation undermine progress achieved, and the poor people suffer the most. Conflicts remain an enormous threat to human development. By the end of 2014, conflicts have enforced almost 60 million people to abandon their homes, the highest level recorded since the Second World War.
I am now the numbers person, so you will not be surprised that you will see a lot of numbers, and because numbers are easier seen than heard, I have this in the back. Goal number one, in 1990, our reference year, nearly half of the population in the developing world lived on less than $125 a day. That proportion dropped to 14%. So, I mean, in 2015. So that goal has been met, in fact, a number of years ago, and that is, in absolute numbers, a reduction from 1.9 billion people to 836 million people, which is the 1 billion that the Undersecretary General was referring to. This was the good news.
UNICEF has been very proud to support the Millennium Development Goal monitoring efforts over the years, and I'm very pleased to be here today. There are 2.2 billion children under the age of 18 alive in the world today. This report shows that there has been tremendous progress in the lives of children over the MDG period. And indeed, a number of these statistics have already been mentioned. The dramatic decline in the under five mortality rate. Furthermore, a dramatic decline in stunting that is chronic undernutrition of children. But at the same time, as has already been mentioned, this report does point to an unfinished agenda, and the data really do indicate that there are millions of children still in jeopardy. For example, in this year, an estimated 6 million children will die before their fifth birthday. And the really tragic part of this is that the majority of these are preventable deaths.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.